You're listening to special election coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio leading into the November 8th general election. I'm Rick Ryer. Right now we're talking with Christy Greening. Christy lives in Wisconsin Rapids and is running as a Democrat in the 72nd Assembly District, which includes the city of Wisconsin Rapids and communities in several other central Wisconsin counties. She holds degrees in special education from the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point and St. Mary's University, and has worked as an educator for more than 20 years. Christy Greening, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you here today.
Businesses today face significant workforce challenges with more jobs open than workers available to fill them. What can lawmakers do to help mitigate this situation?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that lawmakers can do. And it goes back, again, to working together. You know, we have the situation of the Wisconsin Rapids paper mill here in town that went under 2 years ago. And at the time, there was bills presented to get the folks funding to possibly keep that mill open or allow for a group to purchase it. And there was so misinformation given to the public about that situation. I think bringing back ethics and integrity within our legislative body is the number one thing we need to do to get our economy rolling again. There was the opportunity to have funding for that paper mill, and it was partisan politics that played out, and, you know, we lost it. To bring back the economy, we need jobs that are family-sustaining, paying jobs, jobs that have insurance, that we can have working one job to support a family instead of a parent having to work two or three low-paying jobs. The more money they can bring into their family, the more money that they can spend out in the economy to, again, boost our economy as we go.
What steps can be taken at the state level to address rising inflation and fears of recession, and what legislative steps would you consider taking?
Well, I think when we think of inflation, when I've talked with folks across the district, we seem to have this mindset that inflation is only happening here in the United States. It's not. It's happening worldwide. We, of course, are concerned about it right here, you know, in the state of Wisconsin. So that's a great question. How are we going to address inflation here in the state? We have a large surplus in our what we call the rainy day fund through the budget. Governor Evers has tried in numerous ways to access that rainy day fund and get, I don't want to use the word stimulus, but economic assistance to small businesses. That is where some of this money would have come to help the mill, you know, here 2 years ago, where he wanted to pull that money from the rainy day fund. The partisan politics needs to stop. It goes back to that every single time. We have an overabundance of money available within our budget, and again, the rainy day fund that can be used to help the economy, help, you know, bring down the inflation. We just have to work together to use it, instead of fighting between it's one way or the other way. We need to come together for the people of Wisconsin and work together, use that money in whatever way is necessary to stimulate our economy and get moving back in the right direction. That's what that money is there for. And it's just sitting there unused.
Wisconsin's 172-year-old abortion ban was reinstated after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. According to a recent Gallup poll, 13% of people oppose abortion in all circumstances, while 35% support abortion under all circumstances. 50% support abortion under some circumstances. Should Wisconsin's existing abortion law be updated in any way?
Yes, absolutely. I wholeheartedly and unapologetically support a woman's right to contraception, abortion, fertility treatment, and their right to make independent choices about their own individual reproductive health. Government is overstepping when they step into the hospital room and conversation between a female and her physician, and in some cases, the whole family is involved in that decision. It is a very private, a very personal decision that government and religion have no part in. Many of the advocates for the abortion ban are on the religious side of things, and that is absolutely fine. What your religious belief is perfectly legit. I would support your right to believe in any kind of religion you want, but your rights stop when you force your religion and your beliefs on other people. And there's a separation of church and state in our government for a reason. Government has no business being in that doctor's room with that young lady or mother who has to make that horrible or life-altering decision. So I support changes to that bill, absolutely.
Would some of those changes be supporting exceptions for rape or incest?
I would support a woman's right to choose in, under any condition.
Turning now to education and education policy, what would your top priorities be in this area?
In regards to education and education policy, I can tell you from a 20-year veteran in the public school system, funding and how funding is distributed to the public school systems is of great concern and needs to be addressed. Every year, year after year, we have more voucher school and charter school programs entering into our state of Wisconsin here that all get some type of public funding. You know, our tax dollars pay for our public education. And what many of the folks in Wisconsin do not realize is that right now, the way the funding is dispersed, those private school voucher programs are getting first dibs on their money or their allotment over public school. So the best way I can explain it is, and I used this in my last campaign to help people understand, for example, you have 10 students having a pizza party, and each, you know, you can say it's a public school. Each one is guaranteed one slice of pizza. So one slice of pizza, 10 kids. In the door walks four students with a voucher that guarantees them a full slice of that pizza. And what's left of that pizza, the 10 other students then have to share. That is what's happening with our funding for public schools. Our private voucher programs are coming in, taking their full slice of pizza or their full allotment of money, and what is left over is what is dispersed to our public school system. And as more voucher private schools come on to play, less and less is going to our public schools. That needs to change. There needs to be equity in our funding and equity per child as we go through and adjust our public school funding.
What role should schools play in teaching children about social issues such as race or sexuality?
That's a very good question, and one that I believe wholeheartedly, again, going back to my years as a teacher.
Of course.
Are absolutely misconstrued by individuals in the public that haven't been in school in a very long time. They look at and remember how it was when they were a kid versus how they believe things are being taught now. And teachers do an excellent job. When we come face-to-face with one of those very difficult questions regarding race or sexuality, we try to be as open and honest as possible. We always, now more than ever, have to be very careful to leave our personal beliefs or bias or words out of the conversation. And we direct them to the appropriate personnel that should be addressing those situations. If it's a counselor, if it's their career advisor, you know, whoever it may be, the problem is, again, there's a lack of school personnel that can address those and that are educated to address those situations. So.
At the same time, how much authority should parents have over what curriculum is being taught to their kids?
That, again, is a catch-22 question. When you're looking at the public school, you know, there's a set of standards in the state that teachers are mandated to follow. And it's not as if one school can say, I'm not going to teach this standard. We're only teaching that one. You know, we're not going to teach number 10. We're going to teach number 7. You know, that's just not how it's not how it's laid out. And many parents think they can go in and say, well, you can't teach my child about, you know, let's just pick a topic. Maybe the Native American culture here in central Wisconsin. You know, that's part of our history. And for one parent to come in and dictate that we can't teach it, you have another parent on the other side demanding that we do. So, you know, those are very difficult questions. And again, it comes back to, does the general public or the parent that is choosing to be concerned, which is valid, you're a parent, be concerned, do they have the accurate information of what's actually being taught versus what they believe is being taught versus what they're being fed to believe is being taught? Much of this, I'm going to say hoopla that you see in the media about, you know, not teaching this or banning that book, it's all based on misinformation and a hysteria that is being fed to parents and being fed to the community that's not even accurate. If you want to know what's truly being taught, have a civil and respectful conversation with your teachers, with your school, with your school board. But that doesn't seem to be the way things are being done. And instead, hysteria mounts and books get banned and curriculums get ripped apart and shredded instead of honestly looking at what is the concern, let's address it, and let's do it together as a team instead of in an antagonistic and attacking way.
We're talking with Christy Greening. She's a Democrat running for the 72nd Assembly District. Christy, how do we keep our schools and our communities safe in the wake of recent shootings?
First and foremost, I will say this. The number one way to prevent shootings, especially shootings from student to student or student onto teacher, is to be proactive. School funding, I said it earlier and I'll say it again, has a significant impact on a school's ability to foresee a problem and be proactive to address a student's mental health and get them the services that they need. School funding makes a huge difference. Oftentimes, it is the teachers. It is the study hall aides. It is the janitors or the custodians that start to realize the change in a student's behavior first. But when you overload those individuals with multiple tasks that really shouldn't be theirs to worry about, something is going to get missed and something is going to get skipped. We need to go back to funding our counselors, funding mental health services for students, getting our liaison officers back in school, doing the jobs that they are paid to do, and not all the other stuff on top of it, because kids get missed and concerns get missed. And if we can address those sooner, there'd be less issues.
You mentioned a couple of times already the issue with partisanship. Where do you see opportunities for bipartisan cooperation?
Well, being in Madison as much as I have, I'll tell you, until we have more folks elected like myself, who I have a high ethical standard, I am honest, I have integrity, and I have a backbone. I am not afraid to stand up for my constituents, regardless of if it's the party platform or not. And we need more folks elected into office based on what they stand for, you know, in regards to the issues versus what letter is behind their name. Because until we have folks like myself voted into office that are not afraid to stand up and work with both sides or stand up to their own party and say, you know what, we're wrong in this issue, we need to go the other direction, this partisan politics gridlock is going to stand. We need independent thinkers willing to actually represent the people of their district and vote in accordance to how their constituents want them to vote in order to move Wisconsin forward. We need people willing to stand in the middle of the aisle and work with both sides. And right now we don't have that, which means we need new faces in Madison willing to do it. And I'm one of those people.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to get to clean water questions here. How should the state address contamination by PFAS and other chemicals in our local water supply?
Well, first and foremost, the current party in charge, the public Republic majority, needs to accept and address the fact that there is a problem. I have been in Madison on clean water issues for over a decade, and I can tell you that this is a partisan issue. And clean water and clean drinking water and keeping our lakes and rivers and streams here in the state of Wisconsin for our tourism industry, for our manufacturing industry, should not be a partisan issue. But it is. We need to come together to acknowledge the fact that agriculture in the state of Wisconsin does have a hand in the nitrate levels across our state in our drinking water. Nitrate levels are going up exponentially around large-scale agricultural facilities. We have private wells registering from the 20s, the 30s, the 40 parts per million. You cannot drink it when it's 10 points per million or higher. On the other side of things, the manufacturing side of things, we have to address the fact that, yes, manufacturing is polluting our water with PFAS. Those are forever chemicals. We need to start holding polluters accountable. I can tell you for the last decade that I've been down in Madison, they are fully aware that they are polluting the waters of our state. And they are continuing to get away with it. And certain lobby interests down in Madison are continuing to lobby for them to get restrictions limited or lessened. And it's at the risk and at the health of Wisconsinites across the state. So number one, we need to address and acknowledge who is doing it, and then work with them, work with our agricultural community, work with our business community to say what is fair, what is equitable, how can we help you, how can we get this fixed, let's do it together, instead of an us versus them, you know, victim and perpetrator. We need to get rid of that and work together.
You're listening to special election coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Ryer, thanking our guest, Christy Greening, who is seeking to represent the 72nd Assembly District. Christy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Continuing our coverage of the 72nd Assembly District, we talk now with incumbent Republican Scott Krug. He's from Nacoosa and has served the district since 2011. Representative Krug holds a degree in psychology and is a former Wood County Drug Court Coordinator and Juneau County Sheriff's Deputy. Scott, welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's great to be back, Rick. I love doing these interviews and getting information out to people as best we all can.
Businesses today are facing significant workforce challenges with more jobs than there are workers available to fill them. What can lawmakers do to help mitigate the situation?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I've been the chairman of the Public Benefit Reform Committee for the last three sessions in the Assembly, and I think the biggest thing we've focused on in that committee is how to make work be the thing that helps people the most. In some circumstances, it's easier for people to find the benefit program that actually pays more than full-time employment does from time to time because of the way wages have been set. Now employers are finding that people are in more demand, and I think it's incumbent upon us to find a way to make work actually worth it for people. So what we proposed last session and what I'll propose again this session is finding a sliding scale for all of our public benefit programs. So if somebody starts earning to the point where they don't qualify, they're not cut off entirely, but they can go to work and have this sliding scale where the benefit reduces a little bit each month so they can start to budget for their life changes because of the employment. So we're really focused on trying to make that committee more geared towards helping people than hurting people.
Inflation is also the big topic of the day. It hurts people's pocketbooks right on the local level every single day for many working families. What steps can be taken at the state level to address rising inflation and fears of recession locally? And what legislative steps would you consider to take going forward or continue that you're working on now?
I think the biggest thing we can do there is make sure that people have more of their paycheck to take home so they can face the problems that we face with inflation. You know, we don't really cause or help inflation at the state level. That's federal policy. It's really driven the inflation problems over the decades and more so recently. You know, when we start making sure that we take care of the money that's coming into our state and not doling it out for certain pet projects here and there, I think we'll be better off in the long run if we're not wasteful spenders. that we adjust our tax brackets enough for people to be able to bring home more of their paychecks. And when the state's spending less money of those people that are sending it in, and they can keep more of that money, they have some disposable income that they can actually use in our communities that'll help boost up our overall economy. When people don't have disposable income to spend, it really starts impacting our local economies more than anything else. So that's our number one goal, is making sure that when you get that paycheck every month, that you get the absolute most that you can out of it, and that you can trust that the money that you're sending to Madison or to Washington actually gets spent appropriately.
Wisconsin's 172-year-old abortion ban was reinstated after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And according to a recent Gallup poll, 13% of people oppose abortion in all circumstances, while 35% support abortion under all circumstances, and 50% support abortion under some circumstances. Should Wisconsin's existing abortion law be updated in any way from your perspective?
You know, that's the first time we've actually had to deal with this issue on a state level. So I'm really looking forward to next session being able to have this debate that we haven't had the control over for the last 50 years. And I think, as you said, you know, the poll numbers show that probably close to 80% of Wisconsins see a path forward for limited abortions in cases where it's necessary, where it's not a partial birth abortion, but it's still not an abortion ban. So I think most of Wisconsin would like to see us find an updated version of where the 1849 law is. What that comes out to and what the legislature will feel will definitely play a strong role into what we see going forward. But I think to try to follow what the people are asking us to do is one of the most important jobs a state representative can have. And I think that's why we spend so much time in our communities, gauging the interest from our residents, taking feedback on the issue for the first time since we could in the last 50 years, and coming together as policymakers starting in January to start debating that and seeing where the end result comes out. I know most people would say that the 1849 law that's in effect right now has basically stopped all abortions in Wisconsin, that there's no cases where it can be medically necessary anymore, but that's not exactly what the 1849 law does. And I think we'll see that play out in the courts, too, where people are going to start challenging whether that's enforceable, since we've made so many changes to the law in between the time when it was in effect and where it is now. There's a lot of things that surrounding that abortion issue we have to deal with as policymakers coming up in January.
Would you support exceptions to the law for cases involving rape and incest?
I think if we had medically necessary exceptions, I think that's where most of Wisconsinites would land. And I think that's where I'm always kind of been, as if it's necessary to protect the life of the mother under a doctor's advice. I think that's something that we can get to.
Turning to education and education policy, looking ahead, what is your top priority in this area?
I think making sure that kids and parents can decide for themselves what their best educational option is the best policy for the state of Wisconsin, period. I've been a huge advocate for the Choice Program to make that a statewide program, to allow competition back into our school system and to let everybody know that, hey, you've got nothing to worry about, public school system, as long as you're providing the best quality option for the parent to choose. And our local school districts here in Wisconsin Rapids, Nakusa, Port Edwards, Almond Bancroft, and Wild Rose, all my smaller eating districts, have all shown that they've been able to keep that quality to the point where they're not losing students en masse to the voucher type system. So I think just keeping people on an even playing field where they know that if a parent wants to choose something else, they have that option. That is always going to be the best choice for the student, is with having the parents have the decision power and to make that right choice.
What role should schools play in teaching children about social issues such as race and sexuality?
Hot topic issue.
Yes, it is.
We've discussed, for the last two sessions now, we've really gone into this deeply about how much of a role the public school system should have versus the parent system. And I kind of bucked the trend myself when I put forward a financial literacy bill a few years ago. You know, everybody's usually from the right to the left. The right always says the parents should have the responsibility all the time. The left says the school should have more of the responsibilities. But there are times where parents may not know what they need to know to help educate their students into some of those issues. I don't know if Wisconsin will ever get to the point where they start, prohibiting school districts from teaching certain things like other states have. I think we've been open, and as long as our school boards remain receptive to public input and allow the public to testify on any changes to their curriculums, local decisions have to be made by local governing bodies.
Well, that brings me to the next question, is how much authority and input should parents have over that curriculum that is taught to their children at school?
Yeah, there should be a lot of input from parents into the education system of their children. I mean, that's one of the things we've talked about since I've got elected, is how do we empower parents to want to be more involved is one of the problems we face. Is even if we gave them even more power, how do we get them to come to school board meetings? How do we get them to voice their opinions more often? How do we get them to be involved? And I think education being more of a hot topic issue the last 2 years, I think we're starting to see parents getting more involved, going to school board meetings, trying to voice their opinions. Now we're just trying to make sure we have school boards that want to hear those opinions and give those parents time to do that. And I think that's a healthy system. That's exactly how the rest of our government is set up. In a representative democracy, a representative republic, we allow people to give us the input that they want us to drive policy with. And that should be no different at the local school board. If the parents in a community think X, Y, and Z should be taught, then the school board should be receptive to that and help teach those students those things that the parents are asking them to do.
We're talking with Representative Scott Krug. Scott is running for re-election for the 72nd Assembly in central Wisconsin. And another hot topic issue is school safety and community safety. How do we keep our schools and communities safe in the wake of recent deadly shootings?
Yeah, we do spend a lot of time on that. We took a big bite at the apple this last session, investing over $100 million into school safety measures and making sure that schools that wanted school resource officers could take advantage of them, to make sure that buildings that needed to be more secured could be, you know, beef up their security. I think the debate always comes back to, you know, who do we trust to come into our schools? How do we trust them? How do we give them access? There are a lot of things that we need to adjust to make sure that schools can take advantage of whatever safety measures they want to and still be in compliance, for example, with the state building code. There are a lot of issues we have to deal with when it comes to gun safety and making sure that people who are obtaining firearms are actually allowed to be obtaining them. We have to deal with a lot of those issues as well. So I think, you know, the $100 million that we put towards that last session and the big chunk that we've put towards mental health issues over the last few years in the state of Wisconsin will go a long way to making sure that we don't see more tragic situations like we have in more states across the country. That's obviously heartbreaking. You know, as a parent, I don't want to see anything like that, obviously, but we've got to be smart as policymakers and punish those who are breaking the law instead of prohibiting those who follow the law from exercising their rights.
There's been a lot of conversation around the dinner table in living rooms about how people are upset about the continued seemingly divisiveness within not only our state legislatures, our school boards, but on a national level too. But bringing it back here to Wisconsin, where do you see opportunities for bipartisan cooperation?
I think we see it every session. I think that's one of the things that's more frustrating to me than anything is that, you know, for example, last session, 92% of the bills we passed had bipartisan votes, and the session before was 95%. But those aren't the most sexy votes that people will call them. They don't get onto the news or broadcast, you know, that the, you know, $2 billion care package got, you know, unanimous support. They don't broadcast some of the things that we do come together on, whether it's veterans issues or whether it's mental health issues or, you know, whether it's environmental issues that we've all recently agreed on the last couple of sessions that don't get reported as much as the arguments between the governor and the speaker. You know, so I think if people step back and really look at the things we actually vote on in our committees and vote on the floor of the state assembly and the state senate, I think they'll see that there's a lot more common sense than gets portrayed sometimes.
And turning to the environment, earlier in the program, you talked about water. And that is a huge issue, especially in central Wisconsin, as it's related to PFAS and other chemicals in our local water supplies. How should the state address this situation?
Yeah, I think we have to give the local governments the support that they need. You know, for example, you know, we don't have a PFAS issue in Wisconsin Rapids so much as, say, a Rhinelander does or parts of Wausau might. But where we have an issue with high nitrates, they don't. So we've got to find a way to continue to provide block grant funding for communities that can apply through DNR or DATCAP or whatever it may be to either help individual landowners be able to fix their well situation, or to be able to help municipalities be able to rectify a situation that comes up. Because over the last 12 years working on water issues, as much as I have, I've come to find out that there's no two situations that are similar. And if the state is not going to be flexible in how we address those, instead of setting hard and fast limits for every single thing, we've got to figure out a way to be more flexible with our funding. And that's the biggest challenge we've had. So one of the biggest successes we've had in the last 2 years was blue-green algae issues. For example, in Lake Peatonwell and Castle Rock here in central and southern Wisconsin, finding site-specific regulations for that individual water body and for the watershed that feeds into it. If we had tried to do that on a statewide level, we would have never solved the issue that we have here locally. So trying to work together with local governments and being now a member of the Adams County Board of Supervisors, we've got a better perspective on how local government can work with the state to try to find ways that impact their communities better than just a one-size-fits-all approach.
You're listening to special election coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Ryer, thanking our guest, Scott Krug, who is seeking another term to serve the people of the 72nd Assembly District. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Anytime, Rick. Thank you.
Now we turn to the 68th Assembly District, a seat currently held by Republican Jesse James, who won the primary to represent the state's 23rd District. We first talk with Republican Karen Hurd. She is from Fall Creek and is a Fall Creek Village trustee. Ms. Hurd is a U.S. Army veteran and a small business owner. Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Turning first to the economy, as a small business owner, businesses today do face significant workforce challenges. With more jobs open than workers are available to fill them, what can lawmakers do to mitigate this situation?
Yeah, we have got to be less regulatory. And so we need to be able, the businesses, small businesses as well as large businesses, but I particularly am familiar with small businesses as an owner myself. We are strapped with a lot of regulatory restrictions and requirements, and it would help us if we could have a little bit less regulation, a little less government in our life, so that we can be the businesses that we want to be, so we can expand, so we can grow. And so that's going to be a part of this solution.
Inflation is another part of the economy that many families are dealing with right now. It's a pocketbook issue. What steps can be taken at the state level to address rising inflation and fears of recession here? And what legislative steps would you consider taking?
Well, what we have to do is that we have to be careful at our spending at the state level, that we're not adding to the inflationary costs, so that we're not spending on things that are not necessary, because then we can take the money that we save to be able to save that to the resident, to the citizen. And in a sense, it's not to give it back to them, but so that we don't have to charge them as much either at the pump, because there's all kinds of transportation aids that we give and that we need to give to our local communities. But we want to be able to spend our money wisely in other areas so that we don't have to tax them in areas that we can control at the state level. So that's one of the ways that we can fight inflation at the state level. Of course, the federal level is where most of the action is going to have to occur.
Wisconsin's 172-year-old abortion ban was reinstated after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. According to a recent Gallup poll, 13% of people oppose abortion in all circumstances, while 35% support abortion under all circumstances, and 50% support abortion under some circumstances. Should Wisconsin's existing abortion law be updated in any way?
Well, we need to look at the health and the safety of the mother. If the mother's life is in danger, and, you know, that it's not just a whimsical wish that, you know, she's just, it's when that's in danger. For instance, if we have a tubular pregnancy, that's when the baby implants in the fallopian tube in the mother. Well, in 6 to 16 weeks, that tube will burst and the baby will die. There is no saving the baby at all. But when that tube bursts, that's going to cause massive internal bleeding in the mother. And if she is under care at that moment when that happens, we'll be able to save her life. But if she's not, and if she can't get to care in time, that mother will die. So in that circumstance, when a mother, that's just one example of a mother's life being in danger, then we need to be able to allow abortions. But the abortion issue is actually, it boils down to a human's rights. You know, when someone's life is in danger, such as a mother, then we need to certainly allow that. But this is a human rights issue. So does the baby have rights? Is the baby a human? Of course, the baby's a human, too. We all have to begin that way. And so that's why I am a pro-life advocate, that we need to also advocate for the rights of the baby and not just allow wholesale abortion just because we want to have an abortion, that it's a form of birth control or it's inconvenient at this time, or the baby has rights, too.
Would you support exceptions to the law for cases involving rape and incest?
Oh, I have really struggled with this one because, see, there's a baby involved, too, and we have human rights there, too. And the issue with this one is, first of all, pregnancy through rape and incest is it's not a high percentage of pregnancies. It's a very, very low percentage of pregnancies. So I think that we're going to have to look at the situation. Is the mother's life in danger? Is she a 9-year-old child? You know, is carrying this baby going to, I mean, a 9-year-old child, this is a very difficult thing. And so, and we do have, unfortunately, you know, children, like I said, it's such a tiny, tiny percentage. And I think we have to apply, is the mother's life in danger? If not, this is still a baby's rights. This baby can't help it that the baby was conceived through a violent act. Does a violent act reprehensible? Absolutely. And whoever committed it needs to be going to jail. You know, they need to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. But this little girl or this woman, whoever was, you know, the victim of this horrendous crime, they're a victim. And what we need to do, we need to support them as a state, at the government level, to support them as much as possible, to give them the counseling, to give them the prenatal care, postnatal care. And certainly they don't have to keep this child. They can give that child up for adoption. But we need to help them because they're going to be scarred and damaged, whether they were pregnant or not, through this reprehensible act. They need help, and they need counseling, and they need us to help them.
Turning now to education, on the issue of education and education policy, what would your top priority be?
As far as education policy, mm-hmm. I want our kids to learn reading and writing and arithmetic. That's the highest priority because that's why they're in school. And so we can give them those skills. That's what we should do as far as teaching them different political ideologies or different, you know, ideas about this issue or that. That's not our job. I substitute teach in the Fall Creek school system. Our priority there is to teach these kids to read and to write and to do math, and that's what it should be.
Well, on that subject, what role should schools play in teaching children about social issues such as race or sexuality?
That's not the school's place. That's not the school's place. The school's place is to teach them academics, and so there are plenty of other organizations, institutions that will teach them, you know, give them the opportunity to learn about these other issues.
And how much authority should parents have over what curriculum is being taught to their kids?
Oh, they absolutely should have a say. They're paying the taxes to be able to send their kids to school. They should have a right to say, oh, you know, this is not math. This is teaching gender identity studies. That's not what I'm sending my kid to school to learn. I want them to learn math. I want them to learn science. I want them to learn to read. So they absolutely should have a say in what their kids are learning. They're the ones who's paying for it.
And what can we do as a state to attract and maintain qualified teachers?
There's lots of regulations on teachers too. And I hear it from them all the time that they love their job. They love teaching children and being with the children and bringing to their lives the skills that they need to be successful in life as far as these skills that I already talked about, reading, writing, and math. But they are burdened with a lot of administrative responsibilities, too. And they said, if I could just teach and not be focused on these other things that we have to do, all these other administrative hoops that they have to jump through. So it would be taking the burden off the teacher in that way. and that would encourage them to stay and to teach.
We're talking with Karen Hurd. Karen is a Republican candidate for the 68th Assembly seat. And Karen, how do we keep our schools and communities safe in the wake of recent deadly shootings?
We must prosecute these people that commit these crimes. We cannot let them back out on the streets. We don't give them low bails or no bails. These are criminals. And then most of these people have a record already, and they're wandering around again on the street. We have to be tough on crime. That's what stops crime, is being tough on crime.
There are many conversations over the dinner table or kitchen, living room conversations about how people are disillusioned or upset with how divisive politics has seemed to have turned from their perspective. Where do you see opportunities for bipartisanship cooperation?
I see it everywhere. I see it everywhere. There was someone who said to me that I was meeting with them on an issue. I'm involved in a pond issue here in Fall Creek and trying to keep it clean and keep our waterways wonderful. And he said, Karen, congratulations on your primary. He said, of all the people that I've everybody that I've ever met, you were able to bring people to the middle and to bring two opposing views together so that we can work for good and to get things done. And that is one of my specialties, and I've always been able to do that. I am not a far right. I'm not a far left. And I'm not going to call myself a moderate either. I'm just saying, let's just come to the table, both sides. Sometimes there's three sides or four sides. There's multiple sides. And let's talk about this. And let's not make knee-jerk reactions. Let's do the research. I am eminent about doing research and about finding out all the facts and looking at it from every angle so that when we come to the table, we all are in possession of what is really happening, not what we think is happening, what is really happening. And then we're able to make good decisions for our people.
And speaking of clean water, which you just mentioned, how should the state address contamination by PFAS and other chemicals in our local water supplies?
Yeah. What we want to do is we want to have all the accurate facts first, because sometimes we're running with just partial facts. This is very, very important. What are the accurate facts? What is the contamination level? And then if it is at dangerous levels, by all means, that we're going to have to clean this up.
You're listening to Special Election Coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Ryer, thanking our guest, Karen Hurd. Karen is seeking to represent the 68th Assembly District. Karen, again, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Nate Otto joins us now. He is from Altoona and is running as a Democrat for the 68th Assembly District. Mr. Otto is an adjunct instructor at Chippewa Valley Technical College in Eau Claire, where he is also a county supervisor. He holds a master's degree in public policy. Nate Otto, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Businesses today face significant workforce challenges, with more jobs open than there are workers available to fill them. What can lawmakers do to help mitigate this situation?
Well, this issue is kind of near to me. My wife owns a small business. She employs up to seven people now, and we're very closely tied with the local business community. I think flexibility is one of the best things businesses can do. In the county board, I'm the vice chair of the Highway Commission, and we're looking for different ways to make the work environment more appealing to workers without having to tax the taxpayers excessively. And one thing we're trying is expanding telecommute options, as well as making different options available, like more flexible schedules, such as non-traditional hours. I think in this post-COVID world, the 9-to-5 or 8-to-5 work week is now under question, that we're not bound to this, that organizations can be more creative about providing employees the flexibility that they need. And along with this, we need to pay workers the wage that they need to live. This, in the long run, makes society more productive.
Inflation continues to be a top of mind issue for many working families in the state. And I wanted to ask you, what steps can be taken at the state level to address rising inflation and fears of a potential recession? And what legislative steps would you consider taking?
Well, there's a lot of concern about short-term issues that might not be the reality 1 year or 2 years from now, because I think we could have not guessed that COVID could have happened. We could have not guessed that the consequences of it would be inflation, occasional supply shortages. So whatever we do, we need to think long-term. And what the state can do in particular is focus on investing in our infrastructure, focus on worker development and training, invest in the UW and technical college system, so we have a more robust workforce to begin with who are able to be more competitive in the workforce. And, we build our people up, and then our workforce in general becomes more resistant to inflation. A big part of fiscal responsibility as well is taking care to seek out where government programs are wasteful and work across government between different levels of government, like have cities and counties cooperate on projects rather than duplicate efforts. I think there's a lot that can be done with that. And I think there's more that we can do with technology, with utilizing automation in government, utilizing AI in government to make things more lean and efficient.
Nate, Wisconsin's 172-year-old abortion ban was reinstated after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. According to a recent Gallup poll, 13% of people oppose abortion in all circumstances, while 35% support abortion under all circumstances, and 50% support abortion under some circumstances. Should Wisconsin's existing abortion law be updated in any way, from your perspective?
Well, I think pro-life or pro-choice, everybody wants to reduce abortion. I mean, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives agree that abortion itself can be expensive and socially stigmatizing and traumatic. So at the same time, it must remain legal. I mean, it is her body, her choice. And the best thing we can do about abortion is keep it legal and look at the conditions that cause it, like conditions like poverty, health, and education are all connected with abortion rates. I think our law needs an update. Abortion must remain an option. And we reduce abortion when we fund women's health care. We reduce abortion when we improve our schools. We reduce abortion when we support family planning services. So, you know, we need abortion legal. I think we need to update our laws to be more 21st century. I can't tell you exactly how that is, but we need programs that keep women's autonomy over their own bodies.
Would you support exceptions to the law for cases involving rape and incest?
Absolutely. Like, you know, my opponent has a very different perspective on abortion legality than I have. And I was somewhat worried. Off of her website, she says, quote, "I am against abortion in the case of rape or incest." I think I strongly disagree with that. People who are pregnant against their will need to have the option to terminate the pregnancy.
Turning to education and education policy, what would your top priority be, Nate?
My top priority in this particular district is actually improving internet access for students in the 68th Assembly District. There are large swaths of the 68th Assembly District that have limited technological resources. In my capacity as an adjunct instructor at CVTC, during COVID, I would teach computer programming classes online, and it was a challenge when students had either poor equipment or very unpredictable internet connectivity. It was a challenge, and I feel like these students did not get the education resources they needed in order to be successful. So as an educator myself in a largely rural district, I think broadband connectivity is essential for making sure everybody has more equal resources at education. Along with that, I would say our teachers are worked very hard. We need to give them more support. And people say it's taxes. Well, I think of it as an investment. We invest in our teachers now, and then we have more productive tax-paying citizens later. It is fiscally responsible to invest in the people who educate our children.
From your perspective, what can we do to attract and maintain qualified and quality teachers in the state?
Well, we do need to increase their pay. We need to release this political pressure on them. It's unfortunate what some interest groups are doing, attacking teachers at work in a way, verbally, talking about how they are spreading critical race theory, which I was kind of surprised that that's that people believe it's a large issue.
Well, with that, what role should schools play in teaching children about social issues such as race or sexuality?
That's a tough question. I mean, there's no eliminating past politics from history, from sexuality. We are by nature a political society. There's one thing in acknowledging what happened. I mean, we need to acknowledge that, yes, slavery happened. Yes, there is such a thing as homosexuality. But there's a difference between acknowledging that and saying you should feel guilty for being white. I don't believe any teacher is telling students they should feel guilty for being white. I think they're merely explaining past historic interpretations. Knowing the teachers that I know, they're already too hard worked. And if they were trying to advocate one political lean or another, it seems far-fetched that they would even have time to do that when they need to teach their curriculum, when they're busy telling kids to stop falling asleep, when they're worried about school security.
Well, and speaking of curriculum, how much authority or input should parents have over what is being taught to their children at school?
I think the parents need to be involved. School boards have a very important place. I know people on the school board, and we need to foster an environment where people can openly disagree. You think about it, parent associations and school boards, really, they are the voice of the parents. School boards through formal voting, PTAs through informal gathering. And if parents can get more involved with cooler heads, I know that's a hard ask. parents feel pretty passionate about my kids. I'm passionate about what my kids are learning. Then we can get that. But a short answer is yes, parents should have involvement in what their kids are teaching. They should express their involvement at the polls by getting involved in parent-teacher associations.
You mentioned just a little bit ago about school security. How do we keep our schools and our communities safe in the wake of recent deadly shootings?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, every time I see a news headline, school shooting, for a split second, I think, is that Altoona? And that split second is awful. It's a large issue that a lot of it has to do with better mental health funding. Mental health is increasingly a problem among people of all ages that we need to address. We need better funding for health services. But also, it is really easy for children in this society to obtain terrible devices that are very efficient devices at killing. No Democrat wants to take away everybody's guns. I do not want to take away everybody's guns. I believe guns, like any significant product, any significant device, need to be sensibly regulated. So better legal gun regulation, better mental health and support, and I think we'll see a drop in school shootings. And this issue, again, is near and dear to me with two kids in the Altoona school system.
Where do you see opportunities for bipartisan cooperation in Wisconsin?
A big one is in green energy. I know a lot of Republicans in Minnesota. My father-in-law was a state legislator in Minnesota, a Republican, and he invests in a solar farm and wind projects. An issue like green energy is one where it can be seen as a very pro-business issue, where people can get together and boost our economy, create jobs, while at the same time providing a benefit to the environment. So that's one point that I think we can see eye to eye on. Another is rural broadband. I think Republicans understand that, or the need to improve rural broadband for the sake of helping out the urban-rural divide. I mean, there are a lot of lower-income areas, particularly Clark County, eastern Eau Claire County, southern southeast Chippewa County, that could really use this economic boost and create this economic activity. And really, in general, Republicans and Democrats have so much more in common than the media likes to tell us. About every Friday night or so, every other Friday night, I get together with a friend of mine. We go for a 2 or 3 mile walk. And my friend is every bit as conservative as I am liberal. And we openly talk religion and politics, or politics. We openly talk politics. Learn not to talk religion. And it's agreed that we do that, but we're not doing it to change each other's mind on the big things. What we do is we just learn what the other side thinks about and how the other side thinks and what we have in common and what we disagree about. And it's becoming clear that we all want to live in a place that is safe, free, and prosperous, and that the Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative divide is really about how to do that, how to achieve our common goal, our common value.
You were talking a little bit about the environment through the green energy. How, you know, a big issue in many parts of Wisconsin, again, a lot in the rural areas, have to do with PFAS and water quality. How should the state address this contamination of PFAS and other chemicals in the local water supplies around the state?
Well, we definitely need to improve funding for testing. I think it's such a large area, and we don't know the complete picture from what I have come to understand. Rapid response testing in particular regarding PFAS contamination. And here, it's kind of a newer field of science as well. This is one area that could really benefit from more research and funding into research. We also need to work with farmers directly to offer assistance, technical assistance to work on water quality. And right now, I'm a member of the Eau Claire Water Alliance, and we're a regional alliance of different groups that is working together to discuss solutions on water quality, because we understand that this issue crosses city, county, assembly district boundaries.
You're listening to special election coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Ryer, thanking our guest, Nate Otto, who is seeking to represent the 68th Assembly District in western Wisconsin. Nate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rick. Have a great day.